Chapter 8, Citizenship by Martha S. Jones. On July 6, 1853, more than 100 delegates took their seats in Corinthian Hall, the grandest meeting place in Rochester, New York. They had made their way from 10 states: Connecticut, Illinois, Indiana, Massachusetts, Michigan, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Vermont, for that year's Colored National Convention. Excluded from political parties, state houses, and Congress, black activists found, in the convention's 3 days of deliberation and discussion, a place for developing ideas, honing strategies, and demonstrating a capacity for full citizenship. The proceedings were models of political debate, organized by Republican principles of representation and run along parliamentary-style rules of order. Though closer to Canada than to New York City, Rochester was an apt site for a black convention. From that city in western New York, one of the leading black activists of the day, Frederick Douglass, published his independent newspapers, The North Star and Frederick Douglass's Paper. Papers like these reached the far corners of black America with news, editorials, lively letters to the editor, and reports on the ideas being generated during colored convention proceedings. Since the first convention met in Philadelphia in 1830, delegates had been advancing the cause of slavery's abolition, which grew to be a force of consequence in national culture and politics. Black abolitionists brought together their distinct voices to promote anti-slavery along with education, commerce, agriculture, and temperance. In doing so, they defined an African-American political agenda with a focus on establishing their citizenship. At the 1853 Rochester Convention, Frederick Douglass took the floor as chair of the Committee on the Declaration of Sentiments and delivered a lesson on what it meant to belong in the United States. He wove together principles from founding documents like the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution with political history, moral philosophy, and Christian theology. His message was unequivocal. Black Americans were, by birth, American citizens. By the principles of the Declaration of Independence, we are American citizens. Within the meaning of the United States Constitution, we are American citizens. By the facts of history and the admission of American statesmen, we are American citizens. By the hardships and trials endured, by the courage and fidelity displayed by our ancestors in defending the liberties and in achieving the independence of our land, we are American citizens. Citizenship is an old concept with roots that stretch back to the ancient world. To be a citizen is to be an insider. It is to belong. A citizen may be guaranteed a place within a set of boundaries and entitled to fundamental rights and bears responsibilities as a member of the polity. Citizenship is a defining feature of democracy in the United States and promises to protect the despised, the unorthodox, and the unwanted from removal, exile, and banishment. However, for most of its first century, the country neglected to define precisely who was a citizen. Its founding texts speak of U.S. citizens, but do not address the question directly. Still, the persistent influence of slavery and anti-black racism on law and politics meant that belonging in the country was determined in part by which side of the color line a person was on. No matter what else they might accomplish, most free black Americans, such as the delegates at the colored conventions, could not become citizens. 21st century Americans become citizens by many routes, including naturalization after marriage and migration. The foremost way to citizenship is, however, the accident of birth. This is due to the first clause of the 14th Amendment, ratified in 1868, which established that all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. This birthright principle is now so foundational that many people assume citizenship in the United States has always worked this way. It has not. Convention delegates struggled over decades to establish the birthright principle as a foundation of American democracy, and today's Constitution reflects their vision when it unceremoniously bestows citizenship upon millions of children each year by virtue of their birth on U.S. soil. The birthright principle distinguishes the United States as a democracy, and while that rule predominates in the Americas, it is not a standard feature of democracies worldwide. Instead, Many nations determine a child's citizenship by a mix of factors in addition to place of birth, including the citizenship status of their parents. Today, some U.S. lawmakers charge that birthright citizenship is an arbitrary or excessive principle by which to define national belonging. The House of Representatives, in each session since 2007, has introduced the Birthright Citizenship Act, a law that would exclude the U.S.-born children of undocumented immigrants from birthrights protections. In 2018, then-President Donald Trump declared his intent to do away with birthright, though the means by which he would do so were never fully disclosed. Remarkably, figures as highly placed as former U.S. Attorney General William Barr and U.S. Supreme Court Associate Justice Amy Coney Barrett, when questioned, have declined to express views about the legal parameters of birthright citizenship, despite the principle having been law for more than 150 years. These dismissals of birthright citizenship's importance overlook the critical history of how this principle has secured the promise of democracy for all, regardless of differences in color, religion, political affiliation, and more. They also erase the decades of work by black activists, joined at times after 1830 by some white anti-slavery allies, to clearly define citizenship in the United States. Their efforts are reflected in the first sentence of the 14th Amendment. In 28 words, it made plain that black Americans were not outsiders, they were citizens. Black Americans have been exploring citizenship and how to secure it since the 18th century. They knew that the Declaration of Independence provided that all men are created equal, and at one point speaks of fellow citizens, but did not explain who was and was not a citizen. The Articles of Confederation, drafted in 1777 to govern the new loose assembly of former colonies, told them nothing about who was a citizen and instead promised that the free inhabitants of each of these states, paupers, vagabonds, and fugitives from justice excepted, shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of free citizens in the several states. It was not even clear who had the authority to rectify the oversight. The principle of federalism divided governance in the new nation between the states and the federal government, but neither had express authority over citizenship. Ambiguity and confusion followed. In the years after the American Revolution, Paul and Jonathan Cuffey, men of African and Native descent, lived in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, where they were required to pay taxes but denied the right to vote. This, they argued, was a contradiction. If they were to be taxed like white citizens, they could not then be denied citizenship's political rights. In a series of petitions in 1780 and 1781, the brothers demanded to know whether all free Negroes and mulattoes shall have the same privileges in this town of Dartmouth as the white people have. If they were equal to white men, the brothers allowed, they should pay their share of local taxes, but without the right to vote, without privileges equal to those of white taxpayers, they would not. The Cuffeys eventually settled their dispute by paying a reduced tax. Still, they exposed an ambiguity in the new Massachusetts state constitution, which noted, "All men are born free and equal, and have certain natural, essential, and unalienable rights." No one could say for certain whether the Cuffeys were included among all men. The new U.S. Constitution of 1787 more tightly knit together the states and made express provisions for taxation and national defense. The framers engaged in wide-ranging debates across competing interests, Southern versus Northern, slaveholding versus free soil, Republican versus Federalist. But they addressed citizenship only indirectly. Article 2 provided that the president must be a natural-born citizen. Article 1 said that members of the House of Representatives must have been U.S. citizens for at least 7 years. For senators, the requirement was 9 years. Federal courts, the new Constitution provided, could hear disputes between citizens of different states. Citizens of each state were entitled to the privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. Still, nowhere did the Constitution define what made one a citizen. This ambiguity frustrated clergy member Absalom Jones and the men and women of Philadelphia's Free African Society. By the end of the 18th century, their city was home to a community of formerly enslaved people and their descendants, free Black Americans, that had burgeoned after 1780, when Pennsylvania began to gradually abolish slavery. They busily built churches, mutual aid societies, and their own political culture, even as their lives were plagued by racism. Federal laws, such as the 1790 Naturalization Act, set in place a color line that excluded Black people from citizenship by way of naturalization, further creating an atmosphere of uncertainty about where they stood before the law. In 1799, 71 Black Philadelphians lodged a formal claim and insisted on their entitlement to liberties and unalienable rights, and likened themselves to every other class of citizen within the jurisdiction of the United States. The petition arrived in Congress in January 1800, where representatives managed to do little more than disagree. There was not even a consensus about whether Black Americans had a right to petition Congress in the first place, though the First Amendment guaranteed the right of the people to petition the government for a redress of grievances. When it came to the question of whether Black Americans enjoyed the rights of citizens, the House considered the petition only long enough to send it to a committee, where it quietly died. Dissension and contradiction persisted into the 1820s. None among the country's political and legal elite were willing to answer the citizenship question that stalked Black Americans. In 1821, an appeal from customs official William Lindsay, the collector for the port of Norfolk, Virginia, asked U.S. Attorney General William Wirt, "Could a free Black man command an American merchant vessel?" Federal law, Lindsay understood, barred non-citizens from commanding such ships. Wirt's answer confused as much as it clarified. The Attorney General wrote, "I am of the opinion that the Constitution, by the description of citizens of the United States, intended those only who enjoyed the full and equal privileges of white citizens in the state of their residence. It followed that because free Black Virginians were not full and equal citizens of their state, they could not be citizens of the United States. They were instead, in Wirt's view, mere residents." But he also left the door open to the idea that if a Black person's home state deemed them a citizen, as did some northern states such as Massachusetts and New York, they might also be citizens of the United States. Wirt answered the Norfolk official's question, but he did not settle much else. Congress was similarly muddled in its thinking about Black citizenship. In 1820, the Western Territory of Missouri was admitted as a new state. In what became known as the Missouri Compromise, Congress decided that slavery would be permitted in Missouri but prohibited in all other parts of the Louisiana Purchase north of the 3630 parallel, a surveyor's line that arbitrarily delineated north from south. But soon a second disagreement erupted when lawmakers in Missouri proposed a constitution that flat-out barred free Negroes and mulattoes from the state. Debate on this restriction gave Congress a chance to say whether the Constitution guaranteed to Black Americans, as citizens of the various states, equal rights under the Privileges and Immunities Clause. It was clear that Missouri could not, for example, bar citizens from Ohio from entering. The proposed prohibition against Black migration to Missouri might violate this principle, but only if Black Americans were citizens. If Congress found Missouri's proposal to be in violation of the Privileges and Immunities Clause, it would be a roundabout way of affirming Black citizenship. Members became mired in disagreement and deliberated for many weeks. In 1821, Representative Josiah Butler of New Hampshire and Representative John Floyd of Virginia faced off on the House floor. Butler argued that in northern states, such as Massachusetts, the rights of the colored citizens are as sacred as those of the white citizens. In Butler's view, Black Americans were unequivocally citizens of the state and by implication entitled to constitutional protection. Floyd deemed such a proposition unthinkable and mocked Butler. Who is there that believes black Americans ever had any rights but such as the indulgence of the states permitted? He went so far as to assert that black Americans' privileges could at any time be rescinded. Free black people could even be enslaved without cause or process. Could not the states now seize their persons and make them slaves? Eventually, Congress allowed the ban on black migration to Missouri to remain, but still admonished the new state that it must not pass any law by which any citizen of either of the states in this union shall be excluded from the enjoyment of any of the privileges and immunities to which such citizen is entitled under the Constitution of the United States. Congress self-consciously drew no color line when drafting this provision. Still, life for prospective black migrants to Missouri was, in the end, no less harrowing than it had been before congressional review. Lawmakers again and again fumbled when called upon to settle the question of black citizenship, leaving the country's elite politicians, merchants, lawyers, and philanthropists to devise their own approach. Their most popular solution was known as colonization, a plan to remove black Americans from the United States. The American Colonization Society, ACS, founded in 1816, committed to preserving the United States as a white man's country by ensuring that black Americans would not become citizens. The ACS recruited supporters, raised funds, won public appropriations in some places, and built a network that made colonization one of the largest political movements of the time. Some colonizationists encouraged the abolition of slavery, while others agreed with the organization's open espousal of anti-black racism. Some Southerners opposed colonization, fearing that it might succeed in manumitting enslaved people, but then not live up to removing them from the country. Still, the ACS managed to attract supporters across lines of region and party. In 1822, just 1 year after Congress allowed a ban on black migration to Missouri, the ACS established the West African colony of Liberia, promising migrants economic independence, political autonomy, and citizenship. The society outfitted ships, organized expeditions, and did all it could to encourage black people to leave the United States. The society worked hand in hand with state lawmakers friendly to its cause. These legislators pressured free black Americans into self-exile by enacting local statutes, termed black laws, that restricted their work, movement, and public gatherings. With life in the United States too onerous, the thinking went, black Americans might give in to the enticements of Liberia. In some states, lawmakers proposed new laws that would require free people of color to leave by threat of force, or which predicated manumission by owners on an enslaved person's agreement to leave the country once free. Over the next two decades, more than 4,000 black people would go to Liberia. It fell to black activists to fight for citizenship and resist colonization, and with that, the Colored Convention movement was started. At the inaugural gathering in 1830, black men came together from New England, the Mid-Atlantic, and as far south as Virginia to discuss the rise of black laws and the prospect of leaving the United States. Among them were delegates from Ohio who were being driven out of their state by discriminatory black laws. The way forward was not yet clear. Without a way to ensure their equality, some delegates urged resettling in Canada, where black Americans might be guaranteed that no invidious distinction of color is recognized. There we shall be entitled to all the rights, privileges, and immunities of other citizens. Baltimore delegate Hezekiah Grice returned home from the Philadelphia Convention, determined to fend off exile. He organized the Legal Rights Association, which aimed to prove that black Americans were citizens. His associate, William Watkins, an educator and commentator in the anti-slavery press, summarized the association's argument, one rooted in the Declaration of Independence. This imperishable document, whose attributes are truth, justice, and benevolence, has declared to the world that liberty, in the full sense of the word, is the birthright of all men, consequently of every colored man in the Union, that we are not only born free, but have, by virtue of our existence, certain rights which are emphatically termed inalienable. Watkins asked whether the Constitution had incorporated the Declaration's ideals. The Declaration of Independence is our advocate, and we hope it will yet be ascertained whether or not the Constitution of the United States secures to us those rights which the Declaration so freely accords. This thinking led Watkins to probe the depths of the nation's morals. Why, I emphatically ask, should we not enjoy those rights which all must confess have been wrested from us without the shadow of a crime? What evil could possibly accrue from the adoption by the white people of this nation of a liberal, just, and humane policy towards 300,000 of the homeborn citizens of the United States? While Watkins made his case in newspapers, the same argument animated the deliberations during the Second National Colored Convention held in 1831. There, a resolution recommended that the Declaration of Independence and Constitution of the United States be read in our conventions, believing that the truths contained in the former are incontrovertible, and that the latter guarantees in letter and spirit to every freeman born in this country all the rights and immunities of citizenship. The claim to birthright citizenship had gained traction, and black activists would grow only more resolute. But without political clout, even the text of much-revered documents could not carry the debate. Black Americans watched as the ground beneath them shifted again and again, even in northern free soil states. Slavery was well on its way to being abolished there, yet lawmakers were still excluding black men from political rights. In New York, for example, a new 1821 state constitution imposed a hefty $250 property qualification on black voters, while it eliminated property requirements for white voters. Pennsylvania disenfranchised black men altogether in 1838 by a change to its constitution. While being a citizen did not guarantee the vote, white women were citizens without the franchise in this period, the loss of voting rights was a step backward for men who were building a claim to full belonging. These shifts were preceded by bitter debates among lawmakers, and the lesson was clear. For black Americans, full citizenship would not come by the ballot, nor would it come by way of white lawmakers' benevolence. Instead, the only route to national belonging was through organizing and advocacy. Black activists returned to their own conventions, where the ideal of birthright citizenship galvanized them. They asserted that the Constitution recognized natural-born and naturalized citizens, and that U.S. law recognized citizens and aliens, but no in-between rank. Birthright had always been the rule, as the Constitution's requirement that the president be a natural-born citizen suggested. The idea was a centerpiece of the 1843 Colored Convention held in Buffalo. At that year's meeting, Samuel H. Davis, an Oberlin College graduate, minister, and educator, advocated for the recognition of black Americans as citizens in his keynote address. The U.S. Constitution guaranteed their happiness in any part of the country, he said, along with the elective franchise. Davis insisted that this is our own native land. We love our country, we love our fellow citizens, but we love liberty more. He acknowledged that efforts to secure black citizenship had not yet succeeded. Still, Davis believed that it was up to black activists alone to win that recognition. For ourselves and in ourselves, there is a mighty work to be accomplished, which can come from no other source. 10 years later, when Frederick Douglass spoke to the Colored National Convention in Rochester, everyone knew that his claim to be a citizen was tenuous. The seeds of doubt sprouted everywhere. In 1850, the newly adopted Fugitive Slave Act had put at risk the liberty of men like Douglass by authorizing federal officials, in collusion with enslavers, to capture fugitives who had escaped slavery. free black Americans without well-defined rights risked being branded as fugitives, kidnapped, and enslaved. Moreover, the threat still remained of laws that denied black children public schooling, barred black men from the polls and skilled vocations, and encouraged the idea that free black Americans should be removed or colonized. Douglass and the delegates at the 1853 convention knew that anti-black racism was on the rise. Citizenship was seen as a remedy to these ills. But in Douglass's audience that year were black dissidents who had given up on making a future in the United States. Terming themselves emigrationists, they promoted a movement through which black Americans could choose alternative lives and citizenship in Canada or the Caribbean. Among this movement's most forceful advocates was Douglass's former collaborator at the North Star, Martin Delaney. The two sharply disagreed. Douglass insisted that black Americans should remain in the United States to win full citizenship, while Delaney urged that it was time to pull up stakes and start anew in Africa or elsewhere. Douglass and Delaney did agree on one principle. They were U.S. citizens by birth. Delaney's 1852 book, The Condition, Elevation, Emigration, and Destiny of the Colored People of the United States, Politically Considered, was likely Douglass's primer as he prepared his convention remarks. In that work, Delaney urged that it was time to emigrate from the United States, but he never abandoned his claim to citizenship. "We are Americans, having a birthright citizenship, natural claims upon the country, claims common to all others of our fellow citizens, natural rights, which may, by virtue of unjust laws, be obstructed, but never can be annulled." Even as they disagreed about the way forward, Douglass and Delaney pieced together a theory of birthright citizenship. The colored conventions met on the margins of American politics, but the thinking promoted there was echoed in the deliberations of some of the nation's most elevated institutions, including the U.S. Supreme Court. The Chief Justice of the United States from 1836 to 1864, Roger Brooke Tawney, knew well how the aspirations of free black Americans had been putting pressure on the question of citizenship for years. Back in 1832, as U.S. Attorney General, Tawney had penned an opinion that denied that black people were citizens for the purpose of piloting ships along the nation's coastal waters. In the 1840s, in Supreme Court opinions, Tawney asserted that black Americans had no rights as citizens under the U.S. Constitution. In an 1849 dispute over whether states had the authority to bar the entry of undesirables into their territory, during what were known as the passenger cases, Tawney scoffed at the notion that any state could be required to allow free black people to enter. He went out of his way to point out in his opinion that white citizens had a right to travel between the states, guaranteed by the part of the Constitution that ensured a right to petition the government. For black Americans, Tawney suggested, the Constitution guaranteed nothing. For Tawney, the debate over black citizenship came to a head in 1857 in Dred Scott versus Sanford, brought by an enslaved man in Missouri who claimed to be free. Dred Scott did not plan on claiming citizenship. His foremost concern was winning freedom for himself and his family. In 1846, Scott and his family had faced a crossroads. As enslaved people, they risked being separated and sold to line an owner's pockets. But Scott argued that he was free because he had, with his owner, resided on free soil in Illinois and the Wisconsin Territory, today's Minnesota. The family filed a lawsuit in the Missouri state courts and, after losing there, appealed in federal court. This is where the problem of citizenship reared its head. Only if he was a citizen of Missouri could Scott sue in a federal court. When the case arrived at the U.S. Supreme Court, Tawney directed his attention to the question that had long plagued black Americans. Could Scott, and by implication any black American, sue as a citizen of the United States? The court's decision dealt a blow to the black American claim to citizenship. Tawney ruled that Scott had no right to sue because, as an enslaved person, he was not a citizen. Taney then went a step further. No black American was intended to be a citizen of the United States by the framers. It was a powerful repudiation of the interpretation of the Constitution long promoted by black activists. The nation's highest court declared that blackness rendered them unequivocally non-citizens. But the decision was not unanimous. Associate Justices Benjamin Curtis and John McLean issued written dissents arguing that free black Americans could be citizens of the United States. Their reasoning echoed that which had been promoted for decades by black Americans and endorsed by some white abolitionists and even by Republican lawmakers who did not oppose enslavement but did aim to curb its expansion westward. Justice McLean affirmed that all those born in the United States were citizens by birth. Being born under our Constitution and laws, no naturalization is required as one of foreign birth to make him a citizen. When it came to the Constitution and anti-blackness, McLean quipped, "This is more a matter of taste than of law." Justice Curtis offered a more thorough analysis, one that aligned directly with the arguments that had been made in the colored conventions. The free native-born citizens of each state are citizens of the United States, and as free colored persons born within some of the states are citizens of those states, such persons are also citizens of the United States. Theoretically, then, absent any showing that he was not a citizen of Missouri, Scott should be assumed to be a citizen of the United States, with a right to bring suit in its courts. As for men like Frederick Douglass, those deemed citizens of the states in which they resided, as Douglass was in New York, were citizens of the United States by virtue of birth. Justices Curtis and McLean never acknowledged having been influenced by the deliberations of the colored conventions. Still, the force of black self-defense, which stretched back to the Cuffee brothers in Massachusetts, had pressed the justices and many other lawmakers to confront a question they might otherwise have avoided. Whether they were lonely ship pilots, westward migrants, or enslaved people seeking access to a federal forum in which to claim freedom, black Americans had been insisting for decades that they were citizens of the United States. Were they surprised when the justices echoed their arguments? It is not likely. The official deliberations over black citizenship let them know that their ideas were being felt, even when they did not win the day. In subsequent months, when lower federal courts and state courts alike were asked to enforce Taney's conclusions, they balked and then sided with the views expressed by Justices McLean and Curtis. They set aside Taney's brutal conclusion by parsing the language of his opinion, crafting exceptions to the general rule, and drawing a bright line between the authority of federal versus state judges to say who was a citizen. Despite its intent, Taney's conclusion that black Americans were not citizens of the United States went largely unenforced. Rather than settling the question, Scott versus Sanford further fueled debate. Black activists skipped no opportunity to condemn the decision and never abandoned their claim to be U.S. citizens. Douglass deemed the ruling an open, glaring, and scandalous tissue of lies. Taney, Douglass urged, can do many things, but he cannot perform impossibilities. He cannot change the essential nature of things. Man's right to liberty is self-evident. Douglass urged that a new future was still on the horizon. The glorious birthright of our common humanity will become the inheritance of all the inhabitants of this highly favored country. As for Taney, he despaired upon realizing that he had failed to settle the debate over black citizenship. This confrontation of ideas between Douglass and Taney underscored how the battle over the Constitution's meaning extended beyond the issue of slavery. It was also a battle over citizenship itself. Even before the Civil War's end in 1865, the tide had begun to shift on black citizenship. The first sign came in November 1862, when Edward Bates, Abraham Lincoln's attorney general, was asked to render an opinion about a black seaman who'd been discovered commanding a schooner off the coast of New Jersey. Federal law limited that role to citizens of the United States, and attorneys general as far back as William Wirt in the 1820s and Roger Tawney in the 1830s had tried to settle the question. Bates plainly restated the matter. Who is a citizen? What constitutes a citizen of the United States? He scoured court decisions and the action of the different branches of our political government and discovered no clear answer. The subject is now as little understood in its details and elements, and the question as open to argument and to speculative criticism as it was at the beginning of the government. Bates then broke with the official past and instead echoed the thinking that had emanated from the deliberations of black activists in the colored conventions. Every person born in the country is, at the moment of birth, prima facie, a citizen, and he who would deny it must take upon himself the burden of proving some great disenfranchisement strong enough to override the natural-born right as recognized by the Constitution in terms the most simple and comprehensive and without any reference to race or color or any other accidental circumstance. Bates did not go so far as to deem enslaved black people to be citizens, though he did not close the door on that possibility. But in the case of a free black gentleman from New Jersey, Bates was unequivocal. He could rightly command the vessel in question as a citizen of the United States. 2 years later, the next National Convention of Colored Men met in Syracuse, New York. It was October 1864, 14 months before the 13th Amendment would abolish slavery, and yet delegates were already at work on questions of freedom and citizenship. The minutes report how Ohio delegate John Mercer Langston argued that with freedom came citizenship, and he reviewed Attorney General Bates's opinion, lauding it as a complete answer to the arguments and cavils against us. Freedom, the closing of the door on the long, bloody chapter that had been enslavement, was but a first step for men and women who would now remake their worlds and the nation. In the years that followed, lawmakers transformed the post-war Congress from an ineffectual and muddled body into a staunch promoter of black citizenship. It was a struggle. In the wake of the 13th Amendment's formal abolition of slavery in 1865, white Southerners got to work on imposing a slavery-like regime on the newly freed people. Congress responded by promulgating the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which opened with a declaration of citizenship as birthright. All persons born in the United States and not subject to any foreign power, excluding Indians not taxed, are hereby declared to be citizens of the United States. This phrasing acknowledged that most native peoples were citizens of their own sovereign nations. For black Americans, now neither race nor color nor previous condition of slavery or involuntary servitude disqualified them from claiming new affirmative rights, to make and enforce contracts, to sue, be parties and give evidence, to inherit, purchase, lease, sell, hold, and convey real and personal property, and to full and equal benefit of all laws and proceedings for the security of persons and property as is enjoyed by white citizens. For the act to become law, Congress had to organize the two-thirds majority needed to override a veto from President Andrew Johnson, who had decried the act's challenge to white supremacy. The distinction of race and color is by the bill made to operate in favor of the colored and against the white race. He did not mask what troubled him. The affirmation is citizens of the Chinese of the Pacific states, Indians subject to taxation, the people called gypsies, as well as the entire race designated as blacks, people of color, Negroes, mulattoes, and persons of African blood. But for the first time, Congress overrode a president in a dispute over major legislation, and birthright citizenship became federal law. While Congress and the president battled over the Civil Rights Act, black activists called for radical Republican legislators to produce what would become the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Over many months in the winter and spring of 1866, the Joint Committee on Reconstruction wrangled over how to ensure equal protection, due process, and voting rights for black men. The final amendment consolidated varied measures. It guaranteed to citizens privileges and immunities, and to all persons due process and equal protection of the laws. Penalized states that denied any male inhabitants the vote, limited the holding of federal offices to those who could take an ironclad oath to having supported the Constitution in the face of the recent rebellion, and repudiated the Confederate debt and barred compensation to former enslavers for the loss of their property and human beings. Finally, it empowered Congress to enforce the amendment. Only late in its deliberations did the Senate add birthright citizenship to a new first section of the Joint Committee's amendment. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. The principle was by now familiar, mimicking the terms of the Civil Rights Act of 1866. Still, opponents spun out what they deemed to be the clause's regrettable effects. It would transform people of color into the constitutional equals of white Americans. They could not stop approval of the amendment's new birthright provision, but their objections underscored how consequential a transformation it would bring. The new 14th Amendment put birthright on secure footing, insulating it from the changing winds of politics and the shifting minds of subsequent sessions of Congress. In June 1866, the proposed amendment was sent on to the states for ratification. Most of the former Confederate states refused to ratify. Congress then passed the Reconstruction Act of 1867, which mandated the establishment of new governments in the South, with black men now eligible to vote and hold office, and required ratification of the 14th Amendment as a condition of readmission into the Union. In just over 2 years, in July 1868, the requisite 28 states had approved the amendment and it was ratified. Notably, however, 3 of the 4 slaveholding border states that had remained in the Union, Delaware, Maryland, and Kentucky, did not ratify the amendment until years later, in 1901, 1959, and 1976, respectively. Ambivalence about black citizenship persisted. When the 1869 National Convention of the Colored Men of America met in Washington, D.C., it did so under new terms. Over 4 days, men from 21 states and the District of Columbia moved between meetings at the Union League Hall and Israel Bethel Church. Among them were luminaries, including Frederick Douglass, who was 51 years old, but had been recognized as a citizen for only 5 months by the new 14th Amendment. Or perhaps he'd been a citizen for 2 years by the terms of the 1866 Civil Rights Act. Douglass was among the more than 5 million black Americans who were finally assured their place in the body politic by way of Congress's Grand Democratizing Act. The new amendment had finally affirmed the principles for which the colored conventions, dozens of them over nearly 4 decades, had stood. Black Americans were citizens of the United States by virtue of birthright. That, and nothing more, made them equals to all other Americans. Those who had instigated the 1869 meeting rooted their urgings in an expansive view of the 14th Amendment. Surely citizenship carries with it the rights of citizens. That, they insisted, included the right to vote. Delegates knew that while a guarantee of citizenship was a milestone, they would need to breathe meaning into their new status. What, they asked, did sweeping phrases such as equal protection and due process mean? While the Civil War and Reconstruction seemed to establish the unassailable belonging of black Americans, persistent discrimination and organized violence required that they exercise renewed vigilance. In a short time, convention-goers had already become veterans of struggles over land ownership, labor conditions, family autonomy, mobility, public education, and armed self-defense. The roll call of delegates reflected the new far-ranging reach of black politics, with activists from northern states, Frederick Douglass of New York, John Mercer Langston of Ohio, George Downing of Rhode Island, and George Hackett of Maryland, joined by those from the South, George Mabson of North Carolina, James Sims of Georgia, Hales Ellsworth of Alabama, and PBS Pinchback of Louisiana. But not all delegates were seated easily. Helen Johnson of Allegheny City, Pennsylvania, met with objections from Fields Cook of Virginia, who understood the call for this convention to be expressly for colored men. Henry Jerome Brown of Maryland favored seating Johnson and reportedly argued that this was a progressive age and that women would yet have a vote. Johnson was seated, and John Willis Menard of Louisiana cautioned the men about what it meant to wield new power as citizens. The greatest lever in their way was in themselves. They had but one voice in the South, and that was to know no distinctions of color or sex. With citizenship came the grand challenge of showing the way forward on how women fit into the ideals of universal rights. The deliberations eventually turned to voting rights. This was, delegates agreed, an essential instrument in the ongoing struggle for equal protection and due process. They resolved to demand an additional constitutional amendment, one that would go beyond the 14th Amendment's penalty for states that denied voting rights. Black activists aimed to win a guarantee of access to the ballot box. As the convention discussions wrapped up, members organized into delegations and headed out from the meeting hall, crossing the nation's capital to lobby federal officials about what freedom and citizenship should entail, which they believed included access to the polls. Isaiah Weir from Philadelphia spoke for his committee of men from Rhode Island, Maryland, Georgia, the District of Columbia, Illinois, Mississippi, and Pennsylvania when they appeared before the House Judiciary Committee to claim from this nation protection in the exercise of all political rights belonging to us as American citizens. Weir invoked the Declaration of Independence to suggest that they were men prepared to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them. He drew upon the Constitution. We, the people, had delegated to the federal government the obligation to secure the blessings of liberty for all Americans. Voting rights, which had long been controlled by the states, must now be a matter of federal concern. Individual states might try to reject black men as voters, and Congress was obliged to override those race-based barriers. This was, in Weir's view, required by the 13th Amendment's promise of freedom and the 14th Amendment's guarantee of citizenship. Suffrage cannot be extended as a gratuity. The vote belonged to black men, and it was Congress's job to ensure that no one kept them from it. In a matter of weeks, at the end of February 1869, Congress sent the 15th Amendment to the states for ratification. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. President Ulysses Grant endorsed the change. States in New England and the Midwest came on board easily. Congress held the key to readmission to the Union for those Confederate states that had not yet been readmitted and, as with the 14th Amendment, made ratification a condition of statehood. Black men were citizens, and the Constitution now protected their votes. Frederick Douglass knew, of course, that no constitutional amendment alone would settle the long struggles over national belonging. He understood that the pernicious tentacles of racism extended beyond his immediate constituency of black Americans. In an 1867 lecture composed the year before the 14th Amendment was ratified, he had directed attention to related questions about the belonging of Chinese immigrants and their children. His position was unequivocal. They, too, must be made citizens. Would you, he asked, have them naturalized and have them invested with all the rights of American citizenship? I would. Douglass then plunged into a broader debate. I want a home here not only for the Negro, the mulatto, and the Latin races, but I want the Asiatic to find a home here in the United States and feel at home here, both for his sake and for ours. Douglass was prophetic. In 1870, Congress for the first time opened the possibility of citizenship by naturalization to immigrants of African descent, but it declined to do the same for immigrants from China. In the 1880s, Chinese immigrants and their children found their standing in the United States sharply undercut by a series of exclusion acts that limited their entry and mobility in ways that echoed the black laws that had decades before restricted free black Americans. And in 1895, a man of Chinese descent born in the city of San Francisco, Wong Kim Ark, found himself detained in his home city's port, refused entry by federal officials who deemed him a non-citizen. Officials there regarded men like Wong indelibly foreign by virtue of their parents' status as non-citizen Chinese immigrants. It was a devastating deviation from the birthright principle. Only after the 1898 Supreme Court ruling in Wong Kim Ark's case was it clear that Chinese Americans also enjoyed the same birthright protections that black people had fought for decades to enshrine. The colored conventions continued their work into the last decade of the 19th century. Even with questions about freedom and citizenship settled, giving meaning to these principles required vigilance. And in the years following the defeat of Reconstruction's period of interracial governance, a push for white rule in the South, in politics, business, and everyday life, surged. One-time federal allies of black equality, the Supreme Court and Congress included, backed away from their commitments to a democracy led by black and white men alike. The last National Colored Convention on record was held in 1893. There, gathered in Cincinnati, Ohio, some 500 black activists upheld a tradition that had begun more than six decades earlier. Delegates stood firm in their belief that they were full and equal citizens before the Constitution. They decried the outrages of the day, including the rise of lynching. They were again among the despised. But now, as citizens, they were more fully equipped to demand that the nation live up to its ideals.